Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. Well, with the Great Salt Lake again hitting a record low in terms of its water level, today on the show we will turn to a quickly approaching trigger point that could lead to a cascading collapse of the ecosystem on the lake, beginning as early as this summer. And as you'll hear from my guest today, it's not about water surface area or about dust. It's about the salinity of the water and how we're getting close to a point where the lake water will be too salty to support life. Dr. Bonnie Baxter is director of Great Salt Lake Institute at Westminster College. And Bonnie Baxter, thank you very much for making time for this conversation.
Sure. Great to be here.
So the Great Salt Lake has again reached a sad point, you know, a point we were expecting it to reach, a new low in terms of water level, surpassing a previous low that happened in October. A couple of weeks back on this show, I spoke with Kevin Perry, who is an atmospheric scientist at the U of U, and he described the problem of dust that we have been hearing a lot about and the fact that we have been impacted already by dust coming off of the dried up lake bed, which is concerning because there are, you know, various harmful elements in that dust, including arsenic, which itself represents a cancer risk. And there's more Dr. Perry and I talked about, but in that show, he brought up something that you have been warning about, the increase in salinity, in saltiness of lake water as it dries up. And so I'm wondering if just to start with here, could I ask you to explain the basics of what is happening in terms of that water salinity?
Yes. So if you had a bowl of salt water on the table and you let all of the water evaporate out, you would notice that the salt did not evaporate. The salt is left behind. So only water like interfaces with the air and evaporates away. And so as water evaporates, the salt that's in the water concentrates and it gets saltier and saltier and saltier. And there's lots of ways to measure that, but an easy way is just percent, you know? So if you had a third of a cup of water and you filled the cup up, then you would have 33% salt, right? Which is nearly impossible. That's what we have in the North Arm. That's as saturated as you can get. And the South Arm of Great Salt Lake, where the vibrant ecosystem is, has, you know, been really healthy between say 9% and 13% salt over the years. And that keeps the ecosystem happy. All the algae are happy. The invertebrates that eat the algae are happy. And then the birds come in and eat the invertebrates and there's your food chain. So that's what the ecosystem likes. So it can fluctuate a little bit, but it also can get too salty. And that's what we're worried about.
And what are the consequences of it getting too salty? What happens when we reach a certain salinity?
Well, I study the tiny things that live in the lake, the cyanobacteria and the algae and the bacteria, they have restrictions on how salty they can be. And we don't know how long they can hang out at, you know, in water that's too high. Maybe they just go to sleep for a little while and then they wake up and start dividing if you add more water. We don't really know that. We're doing some of those experiments in my lab. So that's the food for the invertebrates. And so if the salt gets too high, the cyanobacteria that we're studying right now starts to die off at about 17% salt. And right now the lake is upwards of 16%. It's headed towards 17%, probably in the next 4 to 6 weeks. So we're getting really worried because we know this cyanobacteria feeds a lot of the lake. It does the work of photosynthesis for the lake. And if it's not doing well, then we worry about, you know, the creatures that eat that cyanobacteria. So there's other algae swimming in the water, and likewise, they have these restrictive salinities, this when it gets too salty and they don't do well. So I think one aspect is the food for the brine shrimp and the brine fly larvae, which also live in the water, these little caterpillars floating around. So those two invertebrates are critical to the whole ecosystem. That's one thing, the microorganisms, the food for those invertebrates. The second thing is the brine fly larvae really don't like it very salty. So if it gets to be 17%, they themselves might not do well. Despite not being able to eat food, they also, their physiology might not work well. Brine shrimp start to get stressed. They have an amazing salt tolerance for an animal, these brine shrimp, and they can live in saturated water, but they don't do well. And so we might see some changes to their reproductive behavior. They might not be able to breed and produce babies. So that's another impact. So you've got the impact on their food and then the impact on them themselves. And so then these birds will keep migrating here and find that they have nothing to eat. And so then that starts to have ramifications on the bird populations. So we think it starts low and works its way up, you know, this effect.
Yeah. I mean, I get it. The cyanobacteria, and then the algae that is threatened, and then those cascading effects. It sounds kind of terrifying to me because it sounds a bit like a dying off of the base of the food chain. And so then,
yeah,
brine shrimp and flies feed on the algae. The birds that come here sometimes nest here, or that use the lake as a, you know, to refuel on their giant migratory journeys that they sometimes do. They rely on that protein source to survive. Birds, especially migratory birds, might not just all become malnourished and die on the lake shore, though maybe some will. There's this sort of, I mean, you study the small world, and so you can probably see it in real time. But for those who are, say, bird watchers, they might not see it as it happens.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. But I think what we've seen at other places where water has dried up, like the Salton Sea, whole populations of birds that used to stop over there don't anymore. And so you're right, you might not see that this season, but you might see it as soon as next year. And, you know, birds also, they're already doing some strange things. We saw these northern shovelers out on Antelope Island back in February, and they were all clustered around eating stuff out of the mud that I've never seen them eat before. And I've never seen them quite clustered like that. Not that I'm a bird expert, but bird watchers are starting to notice some changes in behavior already. And I imagine that this cascading effect will happen quickly enough so that you will see a difference in next year compared to this year, for example.
Also, just to go on the sort of evolutionary timescale for a second, these species have likely, you know, been using the lake for a lot longer than than European colonization,
right,
and our use of the water that feeds the lake, diversion of water, that is to say. And it's just one of those things that I can't help but think about, that millions of years of evolution and coevolution in a particular environment, and then just in a century and a half, that gets really disrupted. And can animals adapt to that?
Right. Well, you know, the Western United States is and into Canada and Mexico, that Western flyway is really a big expanse. And there aren't that many bodies of water that have this kind of biomass to feed those birds. So this is considered to be the most important body of water in the West for migrating birds. So it's really a big deal. And, you know, some birds that come here are like 90% of their population in the world depends on Great Salt Lake. So again, I'm not a bird expert, but those kind of figures just astound me, you know. It's just amazing how important this lake is to that system. And, you know, I know everybody's not a bird watcher and everybody's not thinking about the ecosystem, and there's a million different reasons to care about the lake, but your questions about salinity really get at the potential failure of this ecosystem, and it could be catastrophic.
Bonnie, you know, as you said earlier, you know, we've hit this low point in the lake, and it's supposed to just get lower as far as water levels go into the fall. As you said in this interview and in the New York Times, you're quoted saying that we are likely going to hit this tipping point on salinity in the coming, you know, weeks. Is that inevitable? I mean, is there nothing to be done?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm on a state salinity advisory committee, and we've been looking at possible solutions to getting some of the salt, some of the heavy salt water, pushing it towards the north arm and making the south arm a little less salty. So there are some engineering plans that the state is considering to maybe help the salinity a little bit, but I don't think that's going to be soon because of the density of the water. Like we could start that soon, but it's hard to move dense water around. You know, it will take some time for things to settle out and for it to really make a difference. So I don't know how immediate the solutions are. I mean, the biggest solution is get water to the lake, right? And that's the message that everyone is sending out. But that in itself involves like a year worth of diverting water to get it back to the lake, or to undivert the water to get it back to the lake. And that to me seems like a lot of time. So in terms of immediate solutions, I don't really know of any, but I do know that there are lots of things in the works that might help over time. I do think one important point is we don't know how long the biology can handle the restrictive salinity. And maybe it's that it can hang out there, you know, for a year and just, you know, the brine shrimp don't breed well, the brine flies don't do well, the microbes start to die off. But say we turn things around in a year, could the ecosystem blossom again?
I mean, it's sort of not that there's a solution sitting in front of us, you know, or maybe there is, I don't know, but
right.
But maybe it could is sort of hopeful, optimistic. You're hopeful that could happen, I guess.
Well, okay. So think of if you've ever seen a tide pool at the ocean, where the tide goes out and all of the biology just kind of has these mechanisms to sort of seal up, the barnacles close up and then the water comes back and everybody opens back up again and the anemones are open again. And I wonder how resilient some of this biology can be. And I know that we've done this terrible experiment where we have closed off the north arm of the lake, which used to be connected. And now the north arm is so, so salty. It's above 30%. So we see there that the algae don't thrive. We see there that the cyanobacteria are dead. The brine shrimp, if they make it over the causeway, they're really tiny. They're probably not reproducing. They don't do well. The brine flies don't exist there. The birds don't come there because the ecosystem isn't thriving. So we've done that experiment to letting that water get too salty, and we know it basically collapses the ecosystem. So we don't want to do that for that long period of time, but for a short time, could we recover? That's the question. And, you know, we're working on some of those.
An open question that you were looking at. I'm sorry to do this, but I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind reminding our listeners the history of the causeway, why there is a separation between the two arms of the lake.
Oh, good. Yeah. So early as European settlers came into the valley, and a few decades later, I think it was in the 1920s or 30s, they built a railroad trestle across the middle of the lake in order to move things back and forth by rail car. And some great historic postcards and posters showing that they were advertising like train rides across Great Salt Lake during that time period. And that trestle bridge wasn't a problem for the ecosystem because the water just flowed underneath it back and forth because it was an open wood causeway. Between 1959 and 1961, Union Pacific tried to fix that causeway because it was sinking and not doing well. And instead they replaced it with a rock-filled causeway, which is basically, you know, completely closed in so that it doesn't transfer the water back and forth. And they put some culverts in it. But if you know anything about salt, the salt quickly plugged up the culverts. So it didn't work very well in terms of exchanging the water. And so there is a breach in the causeway so that boats can go back and forth. And Union Pacific repaired that in December of 2016. A lot of people have asked over the years, like, well, should we restore the lake to its natural self and get rid of that causeway? And now it might be that causeway helps save the south arm of the lake. If we can move more of the heavy salt water and prevent it from coming back to the south arm, that might be a solution. So it's kind of ironic that an anthropomorphic invasion of the lake with this railroad causeway might actually turn out to be something that saves the lake. But now that we're seeing the causeway as a potential management tool.
Yeah. Hey, I'm wondering, you know, you talked about the fact that the simple fix that everybody talks about is getting more water onto the lake, and how there's this sort of legal water law is complicated. I guess I'm wondering, is there not some kind of emergency action that could be taken? What would you do right now if you not wave a magic wand, but maybe do something within the realm of reason in terms of intervention? Is there something that we could do to quickly bring water to the lake? Do you know what I mean? Is that
Well, I think that it's kind of shocking that in a situation like this that we don't have policies about. I think lawns have been outlawed in Las Vegas now. I think it's kind of shocking that we haven't looked to water conservation a little more strongly, because the catastrophe of Great Salt Lake drying up could really endanger all of us, and in so many ways. And so it's not just about the birds won't have a place to eat, but it's about, you know, we'll be breathing dust and we'll lose jobs, and it will be living in a horrible valley where we can't even see the mountains. So it will really impact everyone. And so I guess I don't understand water law, and it's not my forte for sure. But I do think that Utah and Salt Lake City are falling short a little bit in terms of what they could do for everyone to help conserve water and get more water to the lake. Now, is that enough water to make a difference? Like, what is the volume that needs to be contributed from each tributary? I don't do those kinds of calculations. And so I'm not sure what kind of contribution that would make, but it is kind of shocking that we're not seeing that.
Yeah, shocking. I guess, I get there's been a great deal of focus on the lake over the past year from state leaders and so on. But I'll note that some in the environmental community, I got a press release from Utah Rivers Council yesterday, for example, and that's indicative of this. Some see the state's focus on the lake now as kind of window dressing. I mean, Utah Rivers Council called it a PR campaign and not much more. I mean, are we too late in addressing this? Do you think we're too late?
I mean, I did co-write the obituary for Great Salt Lake in 2019, so I have been I've been sounding some alarms for some time, and I'm sad that it's come to this without intervention. I understand the activist approach is to sort of wave the flags of it's not enough and that it's window dressing, but that's actually not respecting what happened in the last legislative session, which I think was a remarkable coming together of people for the right reasons. And I hope we continue to see that, because there are a lot of good brains in the mix of people at state agencies who are really thinking about this. I'm in a lot of those meetings, and I'm really impressed with the commitment to saving the lake. And I think Joel Ferry taking over at the Division of Natural Resources is an excellent move. He continues to talk about the lake. So I'm really grateful for the work that is being done at the state level. And I'm really proud of the work of the committees I've been involved in. Is it too little, too late? I don't know. Time will tell. But we can't sit here and do nothing. And it requires collaboration. I mean, finger pointing isn't going to get you anywhere. It really requires all of us working together and all of us being committed to a solution.
It's interesting. It's a question of timing, though. I mean, there are these schemes that are finally or slowly coming into place to get more water to flow downstream, and the fund, that contains millions of dollars that will be managed by a couple of nonprofits to try and deal with water rights and get water to flow downstream. I guess the question that I have is, in an emergency, is there faster emergency action that could be taken? And maybe, I don't know if that's answerable, but just a question that I have that's an open question.
I think it's a good question, and I think we should ask it loudly. And I think that, I guess I, as a scientist, don't have the power to make those decisions happen, nor do I, nor do I have the engineering solutions in my back pocket, but I know there are people out there who do. And I think if the governor had to call a state of emergency, that there certainly could be actions that could be moved into place. But yeah, those are out of my wheelhouse for sure.
Okay. I'll try and get someone in whose wheelhouse they are. That might not be an actual phrase that a person can say. I will try and find someone who can speak to that particular question at some point. But Bonnie, anything else you would say to our listeners about this particular situation that's unfolding?
I think one thing that's interesting to me is how many people have contacted me to tell me their stories about the lake in this last year as it gets close to this perilous place. And I, you know, I'm not from Utah. I moved here 25 years ago, and I am just, I guess, humbled by the stories I've heard. And I realize that this is part of the fabric of the people who live here. This lake is important, and people are waking up and realizing that they don't know what, you know, Salt Lake City, Utah, the Wasatch Front, they don't know what this would be without the lake. And I think we all need to ask ourselves that question, because we're really, really getting close to a situation that is really different than what we have known in the past. So if it's part of the fabric of who we are in Utah, we really need to value that.
Again, that's Dr. Bonnie Baxter, director of Great Salt Lake Institute at Westminster College. And that's all the time we've got for On the Show today. I should mention that this episode of In the Hive is in partnership with the Great Salt Lake Collaborative, a solutions journalism initiative that partners news, education, and media organizations to help inform people about the plight of the Great Salt Lake and what can be done to make a difference before it's too late. You can find all of our stories over at greatsaltlakenews.org. You can find podcasts of this show at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. Both Sides of the Aisle is coming up next.